Okay, my name is Richard S., and we are at our home in Bellevue, Kentucky. And we are interviewing Colleen Kay and about her experiences in AA. Let's see, this is February 11th. And Mary S. is also here to keep us honest.
There's a lot.
So it's February 11th, 2023. So Colleen, tell me a little bit about your life and how you found Alcoholics Anonymous.
Well, first, it's kind of funny to be one of the old mares in the barn. You know? I didn't think that I ever intended to be here long enough to be one of the old mares in the barn. I started drinking when I was 17. I immediately loved drinking alcoholically. Little funny, one of my closest friends in high school taught me how to smoke pot, and I taught her how to drink. And our favorite drink was 151 rum and Boone's mixed with Boone's Farm wine. When we could afford to get both of them, we did, because it got us where we needed to be fast. Now, she is not one of us and has gone on to have a nice family and intellectual career. And, well, I've done all right. God has blessed me. and I continued that. And, you know, if you look back emotionally, it was that I felt a great disconnect from people. I didn't realize at the time, and it may or may not be true, but I think it was just I had a deep-seated fear of people. Whether that was nature or, genetic, I don't know, a nurture. But, what that did in me is that I took a lot of actions to people please so people wouldn't leave me. But I was so afraid of them that I would never let people get to know me, you know? I've heard it called in Alcoholics Anonymous the, pull me, push you syndrome, or being a porcupine with a hug me sign. You know? I know people, I felt isolated, although I always had friends. It wasn't as if, I went through the, the typical middle school mean girl stage where people were mean to me because, who knows. I just happened to be the one in the shitter that day. But, that's kind of where I came in emotionally, what some of the baggage and that self-centeredness, which produced a lot of fear. And the fear has truly robbed me in my life many times of my peace of mind, of being able to rise up to the challenge. I had limited perseverance as a kid in that I somehow had the idea that if you weren't good at something, if you weren't immediately good at something, you should just quit, Like, if you can't do it, don't do it, And that also has come back to bite me in my life. Because, again, the fear of wouldn't try a lot of things because I would declare myself not good at them, and why try? So that's a little bit. So when I started drinking, it really did free me from the bondage of self, I had a lot of drinking. I drank for 14 years, maybe a little bit longer, but somewhere around there. And towards the end of my drinking, I had taken a geographic cure. I had two events in my life. One was the death of my mother, and the other was, one was a breakup and then the death of my mother. And I Yeah, both of those events were events to drink over. You know, like, oh my gosh, I got, you know. It's funny to think about how the inability to feel, to want to feel, instead of being able to sit with uncomfortable emotions and know that without sitting with them, that they're not going away. They're never buried dead. They're only buried. They're going to rise like zombies, and you'll have to deal with them at some point in your sobriety. And I had two friends who lived in the Cincinnati area, and that's how I managed to move here. In December of 1986, I went back to Florida to visit my dad over the Christmas holidays. And oh my gosh, Dad and I went out to breakfast, and I was just so hungover. I don't have a clear recollection of what I did, but that breakfast is clear to me. Somehow, one of our family friends and one of my drinking buddies, and that's a whole funny other story, which we won't go into for this, but was at the restaurant that day. And I said to Donnie, my dad went somewhere, and I've even wondered, did my dad ask Donnie to come talk? I don't know. But I told Donnie, I said, Donnie, I think I have a drinking problem. And he didn't say like, well, say no joke, you know, used to drink with me. Because Donnie had gotten sober. In the 6 months that I had left Florida, Donnie had gotten sober. And he carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And in his car, he drove me back to my dad's house. In his car, he had a big book. And he said, you need to get one of these. I said, okay. And he said, you need to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I said, okay. And he said, you need to get a sponsor. I wasn't sure what one was, but I'd get one. And, you know, because when you know everything, you don't ask questions. You just kind of say, give me a couple of instructions and I'll figure this out. It's what my mind said. So, that night, it's toward, you know, somewhere around the December 31st, January 1st, I had my last drunk. Drank all the beer in my dad's refrigerator.
What year was that?
This is 1986. And somewhere around, you know, I don't have a clear recollection if this was New Year's Eve or January 1st, 87. It's somewhere around in there. And I had my last drunk, and I flew out the next day, flew back to Cincinnati, just so hungover. I mean, in the Atlanta airport, it's not fun on a good day. And when you're hungover and throwing up, it's really bad. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I did, you know, I took I had hope. Now, it was hope born of arrogance, but it was still hope. Because, see, my thoughts were, if it worked for Donnie, it'll do wonders for me, because I just wasn't that bad. And, you know, I had fancied myself a quick study. Sobriety has taught me I'm not so quick, especially when it comes to spiritual matters. But I thought, I'm a quick study, hum a few bars, I'll pick it up, I'll be okay. You know, I don't know if I thought I was going to not ever drink, or I was going to take a break and, you know, drink again. I don't know what I thought, but I had some hope. And I called AA. I don't know if it was exactly, I count January 3rd as my sobriety date, January 3rd, 1987, because that's the day I called AA and they sent me to 405 Oak Street. They wanted to send someone over, and I said, oh no, do not send anybody over. Don't want that. So I walk into, it's, you know, cold, and which is good, because if all the people have been sitting outside, I'd have never walked through all those people. Right? You know, I didn't know how, but I'd have seen it and gone, that looks a little too much for me. So I went to walked into 405 Oak Street, and Rick, He's still around. His nickname was Ranger Rick. And he shook my hand. He said, "Hi, you must be new." And I thought, they just know everybody. I didn't realize that I probably had that, like, oh, wow, look of total fear, you know. What the seal sees before the whale eats him kind of thing. He took me to the kitchen area and introduced me to Mo. And Alma Jean was working the coffee bar. Mm-hmm. And so I whined to Mo. I don't know what I said, but I'm sure I was whining because I get full of one of my persistent character defects is self-pity. And I was totally full of it then, you know, because self-pity comes with the default settings of blame and victim, okay? Two of my favorite default settings. It's your fault and poor me. Mo took me up to the 5:30 Big Book meeting, and it had already started. I don't know what we read, what they read to me. We came back down. She wanted to buy me a book, and I looked at her with as much disdain as I could. I said, "I have money. You know, this is how I remember this, and it seems to be pretty clear." And so I bought my own big book, and I took it home, and I wasn't sleeping. I read the whole thing that night, cover to cover. I mean, I wasn't sleeping. Might as well check it. I was like, I can check that off my list of things to do. I got the book and read it. I have no memory of what it said. I know people read it and go, "I saw myself in that book." I didn't, but I could say I read it. I'm a list, you know, make your list, check it off, get what, you know. So I read the book that night. And I don't know if I went back the next day. I don't know if it was 2 days later. I don't, you know, I'd have to get out a calendar to see what day January 3rd was. And, but I did go back to the 5:30 Big Book because I thought that was the meeting, okay?
The only one.
Yeah, the only meeting. So I went back to it. Now, I'll tell you, I am a quick study. It wasn't very long till I figured out they had meetings. In that same house at 8:30 at night, right downstairs. That was kind of good because I was a little restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, the thing that, like, I could pace like a tiger. I had gone, I don't know how many days I stayed out of work, but apparently I called them because they didn't fire me. I don't know what I told them. And I went back to the 5:30 Big Book study. And then I went downstairs at some point, and I started meeting people. And there was a woman, Patty, who was up by the at the podium after the lead. And she was two things I wanted right then: to be clean and well dressed again, because I'd kind of got a little lax on the hygiene and the clothes shopping kind of thing. And I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said, "Oh, sure, I'd love to." And she said, "Get a piece of paper." So I did. And she gave me things to do, and I thought they were kind of lame, but I thought you got kicked out of AA if you didn't do them. I wasn't too hep on being there, but I didn't want to get kicked out because I didn't know what I was going to get. But, you know, there was... all I could say is there was some attraction or magic that I knew was happening. And I don't know, you know, other than insight from God, I have no idea how else to explain that. So I was doing those things. I'll tell, you know, I asked Patty, I said, "Should I go to those beginner meetings?" Because then I found out they had beginner meetings. And she said, "Okay, sure." So, and I went to my first beginner's meeting, and I saw people getting stuff signed. So I got a meeting schedule from downstairs where it said notes and started getting my thing signed because I thought that that's what you had to do, that I had already, you know. And Metza, you know, Les R. did one of them. He was the one I remember doing the beginner's meeting. Mm-hmm. And just started meeting some characters, you know. I was mostly an Oak Street baby. I mean, where I lived was about 5 blocks from Oak Street at the time. I was an Oak Street baby. Patty got me started really into the steps a lot. Tell just a couple of things and that really stood out. I was, and so being, I went to the 530 Big Book regularly, which was great because people read the books to you. It was, and then shared their experience. So it really made, I mean, you know, and plus that was one of the things I was supposed to do, so I could go to the 530 Big Book, get a meeting in, and read the book, both at the same time. And if my sponsor was there, chatted up with her. But Patty got me started on my steps pretty quickly. I was one time riding. We were riding someplace, and I think we were going, anyway, we were going to a meeting, and she said, you know, you need to get rid of some of that anger. Well, I was incensed. I said, oh, well, how would one get rid of this anger if they were angry, you know? And she said, I'd probably do their 4-step. And I, you know, apparently I'd been told to do it before, and it was, so I couldn't understand the directions, you know, I mean, because even though they're in the book, I'm thinking I only see 3 things. So, but I finally, you know, sat down with her, got the directions, started looking at me, and I got the promise as in the books. I got to digest some chunks of truth about myself. I went to the Saturday meeting, and that may have been where I met Richard, was at the Precisely Group. Met on Queen City Avenue in the old, I don't think the school was there anymore, in the cafeteria of the St. Bonaventure School. Wasn't too far west on Queen City from the old St. Francis Hospital. And so I would go there, and that, I do not remember, I think it either started at 10 or 11 and went to 1 or 2. I mean, you know, till everybody had read and talked, we were not leaving. What I didn't know was that there were some great old-timers there. I mean, you know, I was sitting with some wisdom, and wow, you know, got to get a chance to sit with that kind of wisdom. Big Paul and gigantic Paul. And one time it was a lesson that's taken years to get anywhere spiritually, but it's one that I can trace back to starting learning from the Precisely Group when I was complaining about my dad, arguing with my dad, and one of the old timers said, you know, girlie, there's no argument if you shut up. You know, and learning to keep my mouth shut was just, what a long lesson that has been, you know. But I would say at least 34 years. And it's not fully come to fruition yet. I made some friends. One of my first friends was this woman named Melinda. And she lived in Walnut Hills, too. And I met her at the 530 Big Book. And one Sunday, we were in the living room at Oak Street. Because the meeting on Sunday then was at 12:30. It was, I think, a 12 and 12 at 12:30. And so we'd finished and come downstairs, and you know, she said, you and me, you know, we're not like these people. And I don't say anything, but I you know, it translated then that I'm like these people, and I got to stay. Melinda didn't get to stay. So that was, you know, that was a lesson, and just all kind. I remember telling Patty one time, said, you know, I have no self-esteem. And she said, oh, Colleen, you know, Self-centeredness is thinking about yourself. It doesn't matter what you're thinking, it's just thinking about yourself. And she did not discount, and I know she didn't, that most of us come in with unbelievable egos, but a hefty sack of self-loathing. And for me, it was, I never knew a time when I was not so self-loathing and negative, critical self-talk. And other people get that because of the actions they take while they're drinking. Patty wanted me to get an institution meeting, and apparently I wasn't moving fast enough on getting my own, so she called me up one day and said, I found you an institution meeting Friday nights at University Hospital. And I did that for a while, and then I thought I'd get a social life. I don't know where I thought I was. I mean, it wasn't like I didn't have a I had started making friends, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I wanted to get a social life on Fridays. What I wanted to do was go to Spiritual Fallout, which at the time met at St. Agnes Church, and then moved to the Promises Club. I left there and I got a different meeting, and then I ended up through a series of circumstances doing an institution meeting when? On Friday nights. I said, okay, God, I get it. That's my Friday night social life, you know? And did that until the pandemic essentially closed us out of that meeting. Meetings that I went to, Northern Kentucky didn't. I moved to Northern Kentucky in August of 1987, and it was funny because Patty and Janet wanted to help me, okay? And I could not figure out why they wanted to help me. You know, I still was so out of it. It's like, what? You know, you don't need to help me. I mean, like, really? I don't know. I still went to Oak Street a lot. I had also had starting in August and September of 1987, Nellie started coming to the 5:30 Big Book Study. Now, I had been told to make friends. And as mentioned before, I was a little afraid of people. So, anyway, I wanted to be Nellie's friend, and she did not want to be my friend. She thought I was, she'll tell you, I did not want to be her friend. But she was persistent. We became friends. And you know, through that, because she was much more comfortable with being social than I was, I got out and did things, you know. I went to my first conference the Kentucky State in February of 1988. And a lineup of speakers that was just fabulous. And I mean, many of them have passed on now. They're not on the circuit because, you know, 90-year-olds don't really want to fly any place to talk. It's like, yeah, if you want to drive me to my Sunday night meeting, I'll talk. That started me going, and it was funny because Kentucky State 2023 is coming up, and I still go to the Kentucky State really regularly. And Nellie used to, oh my gosh, it was so much fun because she always had money for breakfast because she loved to play cards. And she would clean those old Kentucky boys, think about, well, what's this woman know about poker? Honey, she'd come back, she'd play till the crack of dawn, and we'd all get to go to breakfast on Nellie's winnings. Oh, my gosh. But the meetings that, so I moved to Kentucky, and there really, in Campbell County, there was not that many meetings. The ones I remembered, I mean, there was a Newport meeting on Tuesday night, but I still went to East One over in Cincinnati. The Southgate group on Friday, but as mentioned before, I had my institution meeting, even though I want to say, and if I had a Friday when I wasn't at the institution, I would go to Spiritual Fallout, which met in Kenton County. And then the Big Egg had started. It was not very old, but it met on Wednesdays. And so I went to, there were two men who I met at the 5:30 Big Book. And one is Tom, his nickname is Trigger, that should tell you who he is. And the other one was Steve W. And he was a nurse. And with their wives, they started the Tuesday Night Big Book Study in May of 1988. The wives started the Al-Anon, went to the Al-Anon group, and they started. And the way we to this day, and I say we, I still attend the Tuesday Night Big Book Study, the pattern of reading that the Tuesday Night Big Book Study does is based on what was going on at the 5:30 Big Book Study. First 164 pages, section of stories. Back to 164, section of stories. And that's the pattern that that group uses today. And I'm, you know, it was a small group. We had a little Mr. Coffee Maker, met up in one of the Sunday school rooms. So that was pretty cool. Tom lives out in the country. Steve went back to college, and who knows? You know, he may still be sober, just living a life someplace else. And so I switched to that meeting. I attended the Big A for a long time. I took a college class on Wednesday night. And I got mad because nobody called me to say they missed me. Now, granted, they all knew where I was. It wasn't like I, you know, hadn't said, I won't be here for several months because I'll be in Lexington on Wednesday nights, you know. What a goof. But my sponsor said, well, that's good because it's time for you to come sit with us at Giant East 4th Street, which by... I guess they moved in 1989 or 90, left East 4th Street in downtown Cincinnati, mm-hmm. and it moved to the Promises Club, which, again, opened in 1988. I think they opened in 87. I remember going to the Promises Club and cleaning that church, and the bathroom, where there's a closet... like a janitor's closet. That was the bathroom then. I mean, not much of a bathroom. You gained 2 pounds, you were, we won't get to use that bathroom because you couldn't turn around. But it was, and the church pews. We still had church pews, mm-hmm. you know, and it'd be like a real church service. You could sit there and they'd be preaching. But I think by the time that 4th Street moved, after they moved, because when that group got to the Promises Club, the Promises Club had a big uptick in revenue just from the size of that group. Mm-hmm. The Sunday morning breakfast group met at a Holiday Inn in Covington, and then I would go to that, and then it moved a couple of times over and then settled at the Promises Club.
And where it moved to the Starlight Ballroom? Did it? Something.
It was a different meeting.
Oh, that was a different meeting.
Yeah, this one moved to, this place called it's now called the Honey Pot. And we met downstairs, mm-hmm. and it also moved to this restaurant out a little further down in Alexandria. It was like something Siam, which, you know, And then finally alighted at the Promises Club, where it is still to this day. Yeah, I stay. And so Campbell County, I have to say with Richard, at one point I was talking with Richard when he was when he worked at Drug Emporium, and we were talking about the fact that there were no meetings in the actual city limits of Fort Thomas. And Richard said, well, there must not be any alcoholics. But I have to tell you, I do fill a whole bunch of Valium and Ativan prescriptions. And we got a good laugh out of that.
Do you remember Pike 27?
Yes, yes, yes. It was a 12 and 12. And that met at St. Joseph's School. And it was named for what was, it's gone now, but there was the remnants of a drive-in movie theater called the Pike 27. And it was a 12 and 12, met on Thursday nights.
Is that still around?
I do not believe it is. If it has come back, because the meeting died. But yeah, I remember that. It was a nice 12 and 12. And then No Regrets. And I don't remember exactly the year that No Regrets. No Regrets was the first meeting actually in the city limits of Fort Thomas.
And that was at St. Catherine's.
At St. Catherine's, yes. It was started by Mary and Joseph.
That's right.
And the building where the meeting for years met in the library at St. Catherine's. But before that building was built, mm-hmm. we met in the science lab. Mm-hmm. Again, with a little teeny Mr. Coffee. And then once that building was met, so I think probably if I could drive by and see the year on that building and tick back to when the construction started on it, we could get the year. I don't know the exact year. 91 92.
I remember when the Gulf War started, I was in a car with Joe, and he was the director at VA in the pharmacy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was thinking, oh, I gotta do this and this and this to prepare for, you know, patients and stuff. I don't remember if that was 90 or 91, but it was early,
mm-hmm.
in the 90s at least. I can contact GSO.
And No Regrets is still going on.
Yeah.
Sunday nights. We moved from St. Catherine's because the diocese of Covington, with the churches under it, wanted groups that were not part of the Catholic Church, you know, were not affiliated with the church or the school, to have liability insurance. Well, the AA groups have it through Northern Kentucky Intergroup, but Al-Anon did not. So Al-Anon came to us and said, hey, you know, we got to move. You interested in moving with us? We said, sure. Took a vote. Yeah, everybody said yeah. And so Dick H. and Tom from Al-Anon found the Baptist church. So we moved to the Baptist. And it turned out to be parking could be a real problem when basketball season was on at St. Catherine's.
Mm-hmm.
So that made it, you know, parking became easier, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave...
What church is that?
First Baptist. Yeah. 600 North Fort Thomas Avenue. Yeah, so I don't know. I still go there. I have turned out to be the coffee maker again, you know. And that's a job for life. Anyone listening to this, I just want you to know coffee maker is a job for life. It's hard to give away unless you get, you know, as the guy who spoke at Noon Oak said, they trick you.
Yeah, I'm coffee maker on Tuesday night, and that's...
I'll see you Tuesday.
Yeah. You coming down?
Yeah.
Oh, for the eating me?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
As Robert V says, he says, I told all my new guys, hey, I'm taking you out to dinner. He says, and then I find eating meat, and that's where we go.
How are new members contacted, and what type of 12-step work was going on, and any 12-step antecedent? I remember we had a magnetic card that we'd carry in our...
Yeah, but you got your note, you know, it was one of our phone books. My Patty was very, you know, if there was a new girl, she made sure that you went over to greet that new girl. And that's a habit I try. I mean, there was one at noon. She escaped before I could go and say, you know, it was her first meeting. So I'm like, well, we all got to get over and shake her hand and welcome her, you know. Mm-hmm. But she, I mean, before we even circled up for the Lord's Prayer, she was out the door. She was like, but this is probably the craziest crowd I've ever seen. I am out of here. The way I was raised, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong, and it doesn't mean that, you know, was that the women gave you their numbers, and the expectation was that you would call them. And, but there are people who get new girls' numbers and call, nowadays, and call that new girl and say, what are you, can I pick you up, can we go to a meeting? Right or wrong, there's so many things you think, you know, it's like, okay, just because I had this perception doesn't mean it's the right one. So, yeah, we would gather them up, take them to meetings, give them that list of things that they needed to do. I don't know. It's, part of it, you know, is just, I don't know who's going to be, you know, the book talks about no one's to be laughed out of countenance if he means business. But I don't know who means business.
Right.
You know, you'll be working with someone, you know, they got it, and I know they're going to, and the next day, you know, then they're not at the meeting, then, you know, you don't hear from them, you call and go, hey, what's up? Or you have to leave a message because they don't answer. Hey, what's up? Hadn't seen you. And then, you know, you find out they died.
Yeah.
Were there, did you have any experiences in service in AA?
Richard, I will tell you my experience, and it's not a good one. Intergroup, Cincinnati Intergroup, used to do all the events. Mary probably remembers, you know, they did the Thanksgiving banquet, and then they had, you know,
Spring Fling,
Halloween dance,
you know,
they did a lot, you know, they had a lot. Well, and I did chair one of the big events, you know, and then there was a regime change, and they got rid of everything. Gratitude breakfast and Thanksgiving banquet was, and the Alcathon were about all the events they did. Boom. They were, you know, they didn't want AA making money. It was like, all right. You know, the groups were supposed to be contributing enough to float them, but as Bill Wilson noted, nothing's worse than, you know, trying to, alcoholics hold on to that money when the basket comes around. So I did chair the Halloween banquet, the Halloween dance, I guess, in 1989. And then I was some group's rep to the Northern Kentucky Steering Committee. And I went to Patty after, I'd been on there a couple of months, not long. I didn't even remember which group it was. And I said, Patty, I'm going to buy a live grenade. I'm going to call for the question, and I'm going to pull the pin. We will either vote or die, as it, and I really don't care which. So she said, well, maybe being in a group rep's not your calling. But that was funny, because we had some members that you could never get to the question. You know, let's just vote. They wanted, if they didn't think the vote was going to go their way, you had to argue it some more. I'm like, uh-uh. I had chaired Rule 62. I think it was 1993, because, and I remember that was because I missed my 20th high school reunion. Mm-hmm. I said, there's one weekend in the whole summer I can't come, and that'd be the weekend we're having. So I'm not there. I chaired Rule 60. I stayed on that committee for some time, and then I've been on the Buckeye Roundup Committee a few times. My favorite position is voice. How hard is that? They give you a few other things to do. You got to show up at every meeting anyway. It's not a bad gig if you can get it. So that's been my foray into service. I pray that should I ever get on intergroup again, will come in with a much calmer attitude. You know, that learning how angry you are. I mean, it's a long journey.
Yes, it is.
It's a long journey. And not always painful. But anyway, can be fun.
Any favorite or special memories of 12-step work or sponsees that you would care to mention?
I've had some fun. You know, I haven't been on the phone tree for a long time. I don't know how many people still call the number, you know. Mm-hmm. But I remember going to we were taking a woman to detox. And I went with a sponsee to pick up this woman. And she had to iron everything. I mean, I think she's ironing her underwear. She had to iron everything. And I said something to the akin, well, we need to go. And she got mad and threw her cigarette lighter at me. And I thought, she didn't really want to go. I believe, because I could certainly smell it, that she just wasn't quite ready to go to detox that night.
You want some water?
No.
Thanks. Sure.
And then when I got an insight into we can differentiate the true from the false. I mean, I had a sponsee that drank a mineral spirits or turpentine, you know, and ended up in the hospital with pneumonia. I mean, because, you know, that stuff, like,
yeah.
And when I went to visit her, and you could even still smell it from outside, so it wasn't very long after she'd been in there, and I said, oh my, you know, and I was talking, I said, have the doctor said you're going to have any damage, any leftover damage? And she says, from pneumonia? And I went, boom. She does not realize she's not in here because she, you know, she doesn't go, yes, she's in there for pneumonia, but she's not been able to backtrack to the fact that,
yeah, she drank mineral spirits.
You know, it's kind of like, getting a DUI and saying, I need to give up driving.
Exactly.
You know, exactly. You're missing the bigger picture.
I should quit driving.
Oh, yeah. And I have to tell you that sponsorship has made a difference in my life. That was starting to outgrow my fear of people at a deeper level, because I did have to make myself much more vulnerable. And that's made a difference in my life. And, you know, being able to, I have a few longtime sponsees, you know, and We're close, you know, we're close. Mm-hmm. And I have some close friends. I haven't been able to spend as much time with Mary over the last 5 years. Case in point, I went the wrong I ventured one way that way rather than that way. Right around the road, woo! What a goof. But, sponsorship. And another thing that I learned too is that some people have alcoholism worse than others. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to have regular treatment of my alcoholism. Putting the plug in the jug did not solve my crazy head is. But I have sponsees that do not work the program like I do. And they appear to be very happy. I have one later in life, you know, alcoholic, came in, went through, I mean, the nip of the ringer was like, came in, worked her 12 steps, goes to almost, you know, goes to one or two meetings a week, is active in other activities in the community, and it's fine. I'm like, geez, you know? And that just, I mean, I'd had the glimpses before, but that's when the kind of that lesson went, there are people who are acute alcoholics, but not chronic. I don't know if that's a good description or not. They are unable to stop drinking, and when they take the spiritual cure, you know, the spiritual treatment, they're okay. Mm-hmm. You know, they were normal in every way except for the effect that alcohol has on them. I thought I was that, and Patty just about fell out the chair laughing. Apparently, that was not what she saw.
Have you noticed any difference to the AA when you came in to how Alcoholics Anonymous is today?
Well, I guess the answer to that, Richard, would be yes and no. There was much more of an attitude, and I don't want to say an attitude, much more of a belief that if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then come on and get busy. And they weren't always kind about saying that. Mm-hmm. Okay? You know? It's like you would sit down and they go, look, we're not really interested in how you feel. You get over there and empty those damn ashtrays and go shake that new girl's hand. And when you've talked to her for 30 minutes, then we'll listen to 5 minutes of how you feel. You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Or they told you to shut up and sit down.
Yeah, so like, here's what you know. And we don't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But, and also, there's, there were plenty of drugs around, but there were, now people come in with equal amounts of drug addiction to alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and people say, well, what, you know, there's no difference. I said, well, yeah, there is in a way in that, you know, everybody can be a dope fiend, you know. Everybody gets a chance to be a dope fiend. What do? You give me enough dope, I'm a dope fiend. If I'm not an alcoholic, you can pour vodka down my gullet, and I may have a little bit of problem detoxing, but I'm like, oh, you know, I come out going, God, don't put any more of that vodka in front of me. If I'm an alcoholic, I'm like, baby, I don't, gastric hemorrhage, who cares? Give me another, mm-hmm. another drink.
Yeah, esophageal, so, yeah.
But I feel like there's, you know, in trying to, I think that that AA does need to take seriously the singleness of purpose. You can be an alcoholic who is also addicted to heroin, or an alcoholic, you know. When you get up, in our meetings, I think that the discussion needs to be around alcoholism. And you could say, oh yeah, I'm in I'm not against anyone talking about drug addiction, because many people say, I've just got to laugh. Bob D would say, he said, you know, because he took a lot of drugs, he says, you know, alcoholism's sort of like being kicked to death by rabbits. Takes a long time before it's really painful and to kill you. He says, whereas drugs are like, you know, being attacked by a lion. Because I think if I went to NA, even though I took a lot of drugs, and I'm sure had, you know, I took speed, but had I had met a chance to smoke methamphetamine, I would have been a meth head. Mm-hmm. And crack, I snorted cocaine, but I didn't get a chance to do crack, but I'm sure I'd have loved it.
Yeah, thank God.
I mean, you know, but I, you know, if I were to go to NA, it would kill me because I'm not one of them. Mm-hmm. I miss the essential element of this. We're all in this together. We all have the same thing. You know, like I don't gamble. So why would I go to Gamblers Anonymous? It's a 12-step program. I don't know. Maybe these don't need to get in there because they're opinions and not very book-based.
Are there any other people that you can think of that were a major influence on your life or sobriety that you've met in AA?
Oh, a bunch. I'm sitting across from Mary. Oh my gosh, we spent hours walking and talking and, you know, sorting out life. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Oh God. You know? Just that those circle of women that were there, you know, Janet and Co and Jeannie and Penny and Stacy and Nellie. And they quotes that I still will come back to me when I need them. I was talking with someone yesterday, and this is something Steve W. said decades ago. He said, I don't know God's will sometimes. So my prayer is, God, I'm going to walk through this door. If this is not the door I'm supposed to go through, please shut it. And if I walk through it, then I know I'm supposed to be there, and there's something for me to learn. And so people say, what should I do? I don't know. You just pray that prayer and then go. Say, I thank you for that intuitive thought. I'm going to do it. Big influence. It's hard to say, Richard, because there was just so many people mm-hmm. who have colored my life. You know, let me see that it's okay to color outside the lines. Brought joy. Now, you know what, as soon as I walk out the door, I'll think of 24 people. Mm-hmm. You know, I was with Mary when she went to see Alice. Alice was, oh, talk about someone who, you know, if you went to Alice and you said, Alice, I'm thinking about drinking, she'd open the cash register at Oak Street, put $2 on the bar and said, the Vernon Manor's still serving as far as I know.
Yeah.
You go to Alice and say, Alice, I'm thinking about killing myself. She said, well, make sure you got 2 bullets in case the first one misses. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. I mean, you were not getting sympathy from Alice. Mm-mm. That I was with Mary, we went to see Alice when she was dying. And that's when she told me one of my favorite quotes, you know? Mm-hmm. If I'm grateful, there's always enough. And if I'm not, you know, if I'm grateful, there's always plenty. If I'm not, there's never enough. Mm-hmm. And that is true. You know, that's true. Mm-hmm. I get that, you know, all kinds of, you know, my book of lessons lately has been around trying to grasp the understanding is that I can't con God. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, well, let go and let God. I got to go through the process of letting go. I've got to be able to sit and say, this is how I really am. Mm-hmm. and that I, you know, no ritual. It's not so much trying, it's trying to get God to see things my way, to make things turn out so I'm comfortable, mm-hmm. you know? And it just seems like I've just come across some, it's like all of a sudden things come into my life that say, here's some more information about that, Colleen, why don't you look into it?
Did you ever go to Russell Street?
Not a lot, but I did. Yes, because I was an Oak Street baby. I remained at Oak Street. Had I gotten sober at Russell Street, I'd have been there. Now that was a trip. You know, I used to laugh with people. I said that was kind of like the bar in Star Wars. You know. You talk about a cast of characters. No, we did, at Oak Street we did. We had a John the Midget, he was interesting.
Yeah, I
remember him. You remember him, mm-hmm. you know, and God. Used to sit in the corner. I tell you where he was sitting at Oak Street.
Mm-hmm. The guy that kept the phone in his briefcase, you want to call God, want to talk to God, and he'd open his briefcase. And
that was Jim W., I think.
Zippity-doo-dah. I mean, I miss the nicknames. You know, people don't have good nicknames. I don't say no one does, but rarely do people have good nicknames anymore.
And everybody always had a nickname.
Yeah, that's right. And that's how you knew them, you know? John. Which John? You know Junkyard John, or John the Midget, or, you know?
Well, you know, Russell Street was a bar. It was a pony keg bar type place before it was Russell Street.
Yeah.
It was called Jess and Dots. And we used to go down there and buy beer when we were kids. I can remember that turning into Russell Street, thinking if God can turn Jess and Dots into Alcoholics Anonymous, he could do anything.
Oh. Is there any other things you'd like to mention? Pretty much I've asked all the questions I had thought of.
I don't know. Just, you know, it's a great journey. It's been a great journey, and I can feel myself choking up now. Although I won't, anyway. I am truly blessed that I got a chance to get sober. And realizing that I didn't get sober because I was more deserving than the next guy who didn't get sober.
Right.
Or, you know, I don't know why I got to grab that brass ring of sobriety when I was going around on that alcoholic merry-go-round. Mm-hmm. Hooray! You know?
It's just the grace of God.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you know, why did I accept it? I don't know.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you, Colleen and Mary, and for taking the time out to share with me your experiences and